This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Human Rights Watch pretends to defend vulnerable people from abuse by powerful forces all around the world. But most of the time, Human Rights Watch defends U.S. foreign policy. And as the pace of prison activism increases by the month, Prison Radio brings you voices from behind the bars.
But first, if you listen to the Democrats, you might believe that the nation and the world are in crisis because of two people, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. But if you've been following Black Agenda Report's discussions with Dr. Anthony Montero, the Du Boisian scholar based in Philadelphia, you've probably developed a more scientific view of what's happening in the world.
I think the last time we talked, I proposed that we're in the fifth stage of what is a general crisis of the capitalist system. And here I was basing my thinking upon both Hilferding, the German social democrat of the early 20th century, and Lenin, the leader of the Russian Revolution, both of whom saw the financialization of the economy as representing a new stage in the development of capitalism. They called it finance capital, state monopoly capitalism, but also it represented a stage of a general crisis of capitalism. Now, of course, that general crisis has not been a static affair. It has gone through stages, and I think we're at a new stage of it, perhaps beginning with the financial meltdown and economic crisis that began around 2007 and reached its high point in 2008, 2009, and represented an existential crisis of the system itself. So we're in a new stage, and of course, those on both the neoliberal globalist side of the capitalist class, as well as those on the neoconservative war hawk side, see one solution, and that is U.S. hegemony. And therefore, both sides are what we could call hegemonist. They want to secure the American empire by the use of economic, financial, and military means. Perhaps the most clear expression of this in the last 25 years was the Obama administration, which tried to, and did in some ways, combine both the neoliberal globalist approach and the military, the neocon military approach. And I guess you could say the Trans-Pacific Partnership on the one side and the coup d'etat in the Ukraine and the encirclement of Russia on its western borders from Europe, both reflected the two aspects that I spoke of. But at a certain point, a political crisis emerged, something approaching a systemic meltdown of the political system and thereby the methods of governance, both of the empire and of the U.S. nation itself. And I think that's where we are now, a new stage of a general crisis, which is both economic, social, ideological, and political, but a specific crisis of the system of political governance. And I think, again, that is a representation of a systemic meltdown of the political system and the collapse of both of the parties of this duopoly.
Well, the crisis politically seems to have been instigated in its more extreme manifestations by the rulers themselves, who then divert attention to the Russians and say that they are behind the political crisis.
Yes, that's true. But I would say another thing. Their policies became so antagonistic to the minimal expectations of the masses of people, what the masses of people expected from the leaders of the country. The neoliberal managerial elite had become so arrogant and had been so unable to effectively deliver to the people of the country that something that looked like a rebellion, a political rebellion at the grassroots level, overtook the elites. And they didn't understand it, still don't understand it, didn't see it coming. And in order to reestablish legitimacy, they have to say that the Russians hacked the election, that Trump and Julian Assange and Putin are an evil triad that are threatening our democracy and Western democracy itself. But I think that is a manifestation, that discourse is a manifestation of what is in effect the inability of the elites to govern the country. And thus the country is becoming, in a certain sense, ungovernable. All of the major institutions face crises of legitimacy. And I think in this period, we've talked about these crises, you know, people don't trust their political leaders. But I think the major manifestation of all of this in this period is the fact that the media, the propaganda, consensus-setting arm of the ruling elite is at its lowest point, perhaps, in the history of the mass media in this country. That crisis is, I would say, reflective of an ideological separation between tens of millions of people, perhaps the majority of the American people, and the elites who rely upon, again, the corporate media to be the arm of propaganda and ideological influence.
And the corporate media and the elites respond with a counteroffensive, crying fake news.
Absolutely. Fake news, fake news sites, and of course, uppermost is RT television. And again, the Russians are subverting our democracy. Places like Black Agenda Report and Truth Out and Truth Dig and on are promoting fake news, kind of a merging of really what is a left source of information with a kind of right-wing nationalist sources of information, and all constitute a kind of, with this broad smearing of every side, and they all constitute fake news, and the only legitimate news is the CNNs and the MSNBCs and the NPRs and the New York Times and Washington Post. But the good news is the people don't believe it.
And that creates a political crisis for the rulers.
That's right. And an ideological crisis. They can no longer have the capacity to convince people of the truth and legitimacy of what they're saying. People don't believe them. And when people no longer believe the elites, it is a crisis of governance. It is a crisis of rule. The country is therefore, I would say, on the verge of becoming ungovernable. That is, they can no longer govern in the ways that they have pretty much for the last 70 years.
But what underlies this is what you referred to earlier, is the fact that the rulers and their two political parties have nothing to offer to the masses of people and cannot even articulate an offer.
That's the point. They have nothing to offer. the system seems incapable of making reforms that could benefit ordinary people. I think, and probably what reflects that most of all, is the failed Obamacare, so-called universal health care policies. I mean, it is an abject failure, and everybody knows it will not work in the long run or the medium run. But that indicates the inability of the system to reform itself from within the boundaries of neoliberalism. Reform, if it is to work, has to be radical reforms that pretty much changes the boundaries within which capitalism operates.
And instead, we see the spectacle of Republicans tearing apart what was an ideal Republican program.
Absolutely. And that's a very interesting thing. And it gets back to the whole question of the attempt of one side of the duopoly, falsely, of course, to establish some legitimacy, recognizing the unpopularity and all of the problems with Obamacare. The Republicans attack their own so-called health care program in an attempt to win political points with broad masses of people who are disenchanted.
We could also apply that to Donald Trump's rhetorical positions on lessening tensions with the Russians and against free trade, although he packs his cabinet with war hawks and billionaires who certainly love the global mobility of money.
Oh, definitely. But, you know, just take the question of free trade versus what is broadly referred to as economic nationalism. We are now reading, I read today in the Financial Times, that a war has broken out within the Trump administration between those who were saying that you ran on that, but you can't govern the world economy based upon withdrawing from neoliberal global policies and these trade deals. And then you get on the other side, you get people within the White House, in the Trump administration, who have a completely opposite view. A view of pulling back from all of this, of reordering the relationships of the U.S. economy to other nations like China, like Russia, like the BRIC nations, like Mexico, and so on. So there is a war within that administration. I mean, it is made up of competing and almost antagonistic sides within the question of the global economy. I would say the same thing on the Russia question. And the question of Russia and détente with Russia and reordering the U.S. relationship with Russia away from the aggressive and warlike policies of the Obama administration. Well, you have people in the Trump administration who are saying that, well, we can attempt to do that, but don't go too far. I think on the other side, you get people who genuinely see an opportunity, not just economically, but politically, to reconsider and reconfigure America's relationships with Russia. I think in particular, Trump has expended enormous political capital in defense of a position that could have brought him down in the general election and which he has held to up to this point. So what will be the outcome? It's hard to say, but it's clearly a point that divides the administration. The Trump administration is not of one mind on any of these major issues. And we have to remember that we're only about 6 weeks into the administration, and there's a lot of infighting and a lot to be resolved yet.
Well, certainly it's a volatile situation. Here we have the Democrats who, in their assault on Trump, are endangering further the legitimacy of U.S. political institutions, like the presidency itself. And at the same time, we have some forces in the Trump administration who ideologically, clearly want to render a shock to the political system. When we have a system that is fragile because of the crisis, these are interesting times.
very interesting times. And I think the way you lay it out is the way it has to be approached. We're dealing with contradictions, political contradictions, both within the ruling class and between the ruling class and the people. Now, the contradiction between the ruling class and the people have the potential of becoming antagonistic. And I would suggest with this crisis of legitimacy, we're very near that, where people openly defy the governing elites. The contradictions within the ruling class are not antagonistic, in my opinion. They're sharp, they're deep, they have an existential character to them, but they are not of the magnitude of what we see between the rulers and the ruled. In that respect, this is a dynamic situation defined by contradictions that emerge in a period when a social system is in decline, and those who have the authority, because of their class and political positions, to manage this system don't know what to do. And rebellions are breaking out all over the world. And we think about Europe, we think about the French elections, we think about the Dutch elections. But I would also draw your attention to South Korea and the fact that the president has been forced to resign. I would draw your attention to the Philippines and Turkey and any number of other countries that are breaking, some dramatically, some not so dramatically, with the idea of U.S. hegemony, and that their role, for example, the role of South Korea, the role of the Philippines, is to support American empire. And they have no national interest worth considering outside of what they do to support the American empire. This is not just an American affair. What we see in the United States is reflected throughout the world. And I should also add South Africa and the crisis of legitimacy of the ANC rule in that country. And all that this means in terms of a reconfiguration of the world system in the face of a declining American hegemon. That's the way I would put it.
Here in the United States, these conflicts and contradictions within the rulers should amount to a kind of opening to the left, if we had any real left to speak of.
Yeah, and that's the point, any real left to speak of. You know, at a time that the left should be talking peace and justice, they seem to have taken up the script from the neoliberals. For example, I think it's a false equivalency to equate Trump, the politician, with, for example, the leaders of the Democratic Party. I think the Democrats have decided that they will align with the most warlike, anti-people, pro-imperialist, pro-empire forces in the United States and perhaps in the world. That's the Democratic Party. It is not a party of liberalism, of reforms that benefit people. It is not a party of peace. It is a party of war. And the attack upon Trump is an attack from the party of war.
An attack from the right.
Absolutely. And again, I would say the party of war is the right. And this is what confounds me, that the so-called radical left, not the liberal left, the radical left, seems to be unable to extricate itself and its narrative from that of the war party. And hence, they fall into the trap of false equivalencies. You know, Trump and the Democrats. Well, I would think strategically, the attack should be upon the Democrats and all of their efforts to impeach, assassinate, or get Trump out of office. I think that's where the attack, not both are equal, because the attack upon Trump is not because he is a misogynist, is not because his anti-immigrant policies, is not because of Islamophobia, it is because of his position on Russia And the great investment of the U.S. elites in containing Russia and China, but in particular Russia, and in fact, if possible, a color revolution in Russia, that is what makes Trump finally, as an individual, finally unacceptable to them. And from the standpoint of peace, Trump got 60 million votes. I know all of those 60 million are not for a detente with Russia, but enough of them are for that. And therefore, in polling data, what we see is that the Trump voters are more pro-detente and pro-peace with Russia than those voters that voted for Hillary Clinton. The Hillary Clinton voters are far more aggressive, far more war-oriented, and these are Democrats. These are so-called liberals. This is a so-called Congressional Black Caucus, who are war hawks. So we have a reversal of sides now. And I think Trump's disruption of the political order cannot be taken lightly. Now, how far it will go depends upon whether or not genuine left forces can raise in a plausible and understandable way for masses of people what the road ahead looks like. And it is not through what most of the so-called radical left are engaged in, an orgy of anti-Trumpism that equals the Rachel Maddows and the Anderson Coopers and the editorial board of the New York Times and the David Brookses and the Paul Krugmans and on and on and on.
Ajamu Baraka, the former vice presidential candidate for the Green Party and also a Black Agenda Report editor, is involved in creating a Black Alliance for Peace and an effort to revive the anti-war movement among Blacks, among leftist Blacks.
I agree with him. I agree, and I've read about what he's doing, and I completely agree with him, and I completely agree with his position that the question of peace is paramount at this time. And I would add, in the immediate sense, more paramount than the question of global warming, because we are closer to a war with Russia, which would go, I think, almost inevitably towards some sort of a nuclear exchange, because the Russian government has said that never again will a war be fought on its territory, and it will defend itself. And it would be a defensive war from their standpoint. They are not the aggressor. The West and the United States in particular is the aggressor. And I think if I understand Ajamu's position, that it is not Trump, it is the neocons within the Democratic Party. The other thing, you know, Barack Obama played a very important role in defeating Keith Ellison, the candidate of reform, a more social Democrat who was aligned with Bernie Sanders.
Although also a war hawk.
You're right. You're right. As is Bernie Sanders, by the way. But they supported Perez, who is a more open war hawk than even Sanders and Keith Ellison. What does that tell us? I think Ajamu is right about this. I think the major strategic enemy of peace is in the Democratic Party, if you want to slice it up that way. And I think that's who we have to go after, rather than finding ways to march in these women's marches and these other marches, which are merely a cover for a deeper, what I consider to be, moving coup d'etat.
You were speaking of color revolutions against the Putin government in the Kremlin, but what the Democrats and their spooks, their CIA and other covert action allies are doing is a kind of color revolution right here.
Absolutely. It looks just like the Ukraine in many ways. You know, a lot of people say that on November 8th, we elected a fascist to the White House, to which I argue the real fascists in this country do not run for elections. They're in the deep state, which you call the real state. They don't run for elections. They lay out what they expect of politicians, and they give them a do or die mandate, and the politicians usually bow down to them. We have a president that has literally gone to war, not only with the corporate media, but with the CIA, and has accused his predecessor of having bugged him during the campaign. I mean, this is huge stuff. So, yes, I think I agree with you.
And how do we take advantage of these fissures, splits, and political crises that beset the enemy?
Well, that's the big question. If we had a left, we could talk more realistically about that. At this point, it's what ordinary people almost spontaneously will arrive at. Now, of course, the work of Black Agenda Report, I think the work that we do here in Philadelphia on a day-to-day basis with people, especially the poor and working class in the Black community, are trying to fulfill both what Ajamu Baraka talks about and what you all talk about in the Black Agenda Report, the political education and mobilization of the masses from the grassroots. And to free up Black people from the Black misleadership class so that we can once again play our historical and necessary role in social transformation in this country. That's the way I look at it. The other thing is the genuine Black left and progressives must separate ourselves from this tiny, dogmatic, almost cultish white left. They can't lead. Among them are forces that really, in a very opportunistic way, are taking advantage of the relative weakness of the movement for Black liberation and the relative weakness of the left within the Black community at this time. But I think most people, especially the masses of Black people, see them for what they are, rank opportunists. But we have to fight, as I know you would agree, for genuine Black left. That the fight for genuine Black left is an internal struggle for self-determination against the Black misleadership class and clarifying the issues for the great mass of Black people. And I think once people are clear about the landscape of ideas, the landscape of politics, the crisis, and so on, people will organize themselves. But the uppermost, the most important questions, let me put it that way, are the ideological questions. The questions of where are we in history? What is actually going on? What is happening in the world? How do world events impact what is going on in this country? Is what is happening in South Korea connected to the political crisis in this country? Is the political crisis in South Africa connected to the political crisis in France and the political crisis in the United States? Is Trump an anomaly, or is he a reflection of a systemic breakdown of a political system? And, you know, finally, the question of crisis. You cannot talk about any of these things without having a concept of crisis and the stage of crisis that the system is currently experiencing.
That was Dr. Anthony Montero speaking from Philadelphia.
Human Rights Watch claims to be a neutral international rights organization, but has always acted as an extension of United States foreign policy. The actual relationship between the international NGO and the superpower is most clear in the case of Rwanda, where the United States backs Paul Kagame's vicious Tutsi minority dictatorship. The Rwandan regime imprisons or kills those that point out that hundreds of thousands of Hutus, who constitute the overwhelming majority of Rwanda's population, were killed by Kagame's forces during the bloodbath of 1994. Human Rights Watch defends the Rwandan government's repression of dissidents like Joseph Nkusi, who lived in exile in Norway but was deported to stand trial in Rwanda for challenging the regime's genocide story. Anne Garrison is a writer living in Oakland, California, and a frequent contributor to Black Agenda Report. She's spent many years covering the repression in Rwanda.
Human Rights Watch like the United States government, is very committed to the genocide against the Tutsi narrative, which is about how in 100 days, the Hutu regime organized the fastest genocide in human history and killed something like 800,000 to a million Tutsis. Now, that's not a plausible story for any number of reasons, including that there were not that many Tutsis in the country. But regarding Joseph Nkusi, he's been extradited and put on trial for telling a different story. He was a Rwandan blogger in Norway. He'd been in Norway for 8 years. Now, what Human Rights Watch has done is to say that that's justifiable. It's justifiable to put him on trial for telling a different story. But then they say, an obvious contradiction, that his freedom of speech should not be violated with regard to his criticism of the current government. So Human Rights Watch will typically defend the rights that are enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. And in the case of Rwanda, they've even criticized the failures of so-called land reform. But they're absolutely rigid on this genocide against the Tutsi narrative, despite all the evidence that it's a much more complex story and that Hutus and Tutsis killed each other.
And in fact, you point out that in Rwanda, it is a violation of law to use any other term than genocide against the Tutsi, not against anybody else, but genocide against the Tutsi, to describe the events of 1994.
Yeah, that was a 2008 constitutional amendment that made genocide against the Tutsi the only legal description.
So pointing out that Hutus were also killed in this bloodletting in 1994 is itself a crime.
Yes. Well, moderate Hutus, when you describe it, you could say Tutsi and moderate Hutu. But genocide against the Tutsis, Rwandan genocide would be illegal, even though the UN resolution on this calls it a genocide against Rwandese people. There was another point when official body of the UN passed a resolution to recognize this term genocide against the Tutsi, and the Rwandan government was jumping up and down about that.
So Human Rights Watch is walking this tightrope, if there's any rope there at all, agreeing with the Rwandan government and its laws that basically forbid any narrative other than the Tutsis were the ones who were victimized by genocide in 1994, but at the same time saying that the freedom of speech of Rwandans, including dissidents, should be respected. But how can you respect folks' freedom of speech if you dictate what should come out of their mouths on pain of going to prison?
Well, they've gone just as far as the U.S. government and the corporate press have gone, which is to acknowledge that President Kagame is a very repressive ruler, that human rights abuses abound in Rwanda and in the Democratic Republic of the Congo as a consequence of his repeated invasions and plunder of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But the one story that neither Human Rights Watch nor the U.S. government will not change is the genocide against the Tutsi story.
And why must they stick, come hell or high water, to that story, despite the volumes of evidence that this was a two-way bloodletting?
Well, the whole ideological infrastructure now for waging humanitarian war is based on the Holocaust and Rwanda. We have to intervene in Libya, in Syria. Other such humanitarian interventions have been proposed. Darfur was probably the first to prevent another Rwanda. And Rwanda has to be interpreted in that particular way to say that it was the world's failure to intervene in 1994 to prevent the genocide. And this story leaves out the fact that the 100 days of massacres were the end of a four-year war, which began when a detachment of the Ugandan army, which was composed of Rwandan refugees, invaded Rwanda from Uganda and waged a four-year war. And on April 6th, assassinated the president of Rwanda, then the president of Rwanda, and the president of Burundi, both of whom were Hutu. And then at the same time, amidst the chaos that began, launched an all-out military offensive to seize power, which could not have been spontaneous. It had to be planned in advance, logistically. And I went ahead and said, assassinated the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi, because I'm absolutely convinced by the evidence. But the distinction that many made is that that has not been adjudicated, that's not been decided in a court of law. It's still being argued in a French court. The case was brought to this French court because French citizens, or France had standing to do this, because French citizens also died when the plane was shot out of the sky.
And this war ultimately culminates in the triumph, the military triumph of Paul Kagame's Tutsi forces. Hutus then flee the country, many into Congo, and are pursued by the Tutsi Rwandan forces, leading to what some have called the largest genocide in the world since World War II.
They pursued Rwandan refugees all the way across Congo. And that war, the war that began in 1996, when Rwanda and Uganda, and at that time Burundi, invaded the Congo, ultimately cost somewhere over, well over, 5.1 million lives. The figure 5.4 million was the conclusion of, I think it's the International Rescue Committee, and that was from 1997 to 2008.
In the interim, many more have died.
Yeah. And when the massacres began in the last 3 months in 1994, the UN Security Council considered some kind of intervention. And Madeleine Albright, representing Bill Clinton, prevented that from happening. U.S. troops were in Uganda, ready to move in once their guy had been put in power, Paul Kagame. And they were willing to tolerate whatever loss of life in order to see their guy take power. So it's not true that the U.S. or the West failed to intervene. In accordance with the will of the U.S., as expressed by Madeleine Albright in the Security Council, an intervention was actually stopped. So the intervention was to stop the intervention and let whatever happen in order to see their guy in power. So in the ideological infrastructure for humanitarian war, the argument is that we failed in Rwanda, therefore we have to bomb Syria, Libya, et cetera. But the fact is that we did intervene in Rwanda. We intervened to stop an intervention. And we backed the aggressive army from the beginning. In 1990, the army that invaded and waged a war that ended in these 100 days of bloodletting.
And so the U.S. crime of 1994 is vastly compounded by using a false version of what the U.S. actually did in 1994 as the philosophical and moral underpinnings for the doctrine of humanitarian military intervention.
Yeah, and I was just in Belgium at the Victoire Ingabire Mohosa Democracy and Peace Prize presentation, and I met with a number of young Rwandans who produce a publication called Jambo News for their refugee community and whoever else is interested in this story and its implications. And they told me that it was a large enough offense to have their story so mistold. But then on top of that, it's another great offense to have it used as an excuse to go to war.
So the terrible crime that was inflicted upon the Rwandan people is then magnified by misuse of the actual nature of the crime.
Exactly. Now, I'd really like to tell you about who won the Victoria Ingabire Mohosa Democracy and Peace Prize Award this year, but I should probably start by telling you who Victoria Ingabire Mohosa is. She's a Rwandan political prisoner who tried to run for president against Paul Kagame in 2010. She went to prison instead. She's been in prison for 7 years. And when she returned to Rwanda, the first thing that she did was go to the memorial, the genocide memorial in Kigali, and ask, where is the commemoration of Hutu people? And her stance has always been that in order for Rwanda to heal, everyone has to be able to mourn their dead. And that was enough to get her thrown under house arrest. And some months later, after the election, she was sent to 1930 prison, where she remains. And the Women's International Network for Democracy and Peace created this prize. And it was a brilliant bit of political organizing, because every year when people come together for this event, which is tons of fun, when they come together for this event, they meet one another. Some people are given the award. I was given the award in 2014. This increases their commitment, and everyone leaves with memories and commitments. And we don't forget Victoria Ingabire. And one thing that these young folks I met with who produced Jumbo Newsnet also said is that the exile and refugee community is discouraged. It's hard for them to see how things are ever going to get any better for their relatives in their homeland, or how all these extraditions for speech crime are going to stop. They don't see how this is going to end. Rwanda is such a ruthless, totalitarian society. Kagame's rule is such a ruthless, complete form of totalitarianism. And they said, however, that the one place where those who are so discouraged draw the line is Victoire Ingabire Umahosa. They are committed to her defense, no matter what. What she did was so courageous, to go back and say, okay, here I am. I am an unarmed woman. I want to challenge you for the presidency. To say this to one of the most brutal totalitarian rulers on the planet. And that challenge changed everything. That year, Rwanda's election got a lot more press. I'm proud to have been part of that. They told Victoria Ingabire not to speak to the press, and she did so anyway, if they called her. No press in Rwanda had the nerve to try to talk to her, but I started calling her and eventually was calling her most every week. And the BBC and ultimately the CBC covered it a bit. You know, there were a lot of assassinations, press assassinations, assassinations of Kagame's enemies outside the borders of Rwanda, even an assassination of an ICTR defense attorney who had a case on appeal in the ICTR appeals court, was representing a defendant whom the Rwandan government did not want to see acquitted. One of the other viable presidential candidates was also thrown in prison, and the vice president of the Rwandan Green Party was found with his head cut off on a riverbank. And this was covered. And it was the end of this fairy tale relationship that the West had had with Kagame, the hero who had led Rwanda to rise from the ashes of genocide to become a hope for all of Africa. He was feted throughout the West for many years until 2010, when this story began to crack, largely because Victoire Ingabire Umahosa returned to Rwanda and mounted this challenge.
And that legal battle over Victoire Ingabire Umahosa continues. It's now at the African Court of Human and People's Rights in Arusha, Tanzania.
Exactly. But at first, when the court accepted her appeal, the Kagame government said, no, we're going to withdraw from the court. The court responded, no, you can't do that. The rules of the court are that you have to give us a year's notice. So you can't just withdraw because you don't want to answer a particular case. So they said they would answer. They went through the initial proceedings. But when the first hearing took place last week, they didn't show up.
So here we have the government of Rwanda, which purports to play a role in reorganizing the African Union, actually bowing out or attempting to bow out of an important judicial arm of governance in Africa.
Well, absolutely. And the African Court of Human and People's Rights has the potential to be a continental court that could replace the ridiculously politically agendized prosecutions of the International Criminal Court, which has made African leaders who have fallen out of favor with the West its primary targets. And Rwanda, Uganda, South Africa, Burundi have all said that they're going to withdraw from the court. I don't know at what stage the formalities are right now, but an exodus, an African exodus from the International Criminal Court has begun. The African Court of Human and People's Rights has the potential to be a real African court.
But Rwanda is threatening to withdraw from it and not submit to any outside intervention judicially.
They've said they're going to withdraw in a year, and with regard to this case, they've simply refused to show up.
What are folks expecting or anticipating from the Trump administration in terms of U.S. relations with Rwanda and Uganda?
Well, that's very interesting because the Rwandan government and its sycophants all really wanted Hillary Clinton to win. The Rwandan government had such a close relationship with the Clintons. Bill Clinton was president when this intervention that was later called a failure to intervene took place. In 1997, he went to Rwanda and shed crocodile tears about not having intervened, even though he did intervene to stop the intervention. And he's been shedding these crocodile tears ever since. He says over and over that failing to intervene in Rwanda was the greatest mistake of his presidency.
But the Rwandan government relies on the backing of the United States and to a lesser extent, Great Britain, for its ability to bully its neighbors in Africa.
Oh, yeah. And Israel. Can't forget Israel here. This weekend, Kagame is speaking at AIPAC. He is the first African leader to address AIPAC, the annual AIPAC public policy conference, and he's the only foreign head of state, aside from Benjamin Netanyahu himself, to be addressing AIPAC this year. And Israel and Rwanda have a very close bond. They have from the beginning after Kagame seized power, and Israel, which has a trademark on the word genocide, allowed Rwanda to use it, and they're very invested in this idea that what happened in Rwanda was like what happened in the Holocaust, that it was a majority population that attempted to destroy a minority population. And they've even added these stories. They've added like Rwanda wings to the National Holocaust Museum and Holocaust museums elsewhere in the world. The Holocaust and Rwanda, meaning the Rwandan genocide, are the two instances cited in the founding documents of humanitarian war ideology. The Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard and the Pentagon produced a book called Mass Atrocity Response Operations, a Military Planning Handbook. And the starting point of this book is that the Holocaust was allowed to happen and the Rwandan genocide was allowed to happen. So we have to be prepared to intervene. And this is the military handbook for doing so. The Holocaust in Rwanda were also cited in Obama's executive order about stopping mass atrocities.
So any threat to this story of the Tutsi Holocaust represents a threat to the foundations of U.S. aggressive military policy in the world.
Yes, it threatens the whole ideological infrastructure of intervention that violates national sovereignty, humanitarian intervention to protect vulnerable civilian populations from their own governments. And Human Rights Watch, for example, is as committed to the idea that that's what's going on in Syria, that Russia and Assad are causing all the civilian casualties there. And we, the U.S. and the West, are therefore obliged to intervene to protect them and not doing enough. Their commitment to that story, no matter what, is as strong as their commitment to the Rwandan story, the mistold story that we failed to intervene when, in fact, we did intervene to stop an intervention.
That was journalist Ann Garrison speaking from Berkeley, California.
Kalfani Malik Khaldun is an inmate at Wabash Valley Prison in southern Indiana. Khaldun recently published an essay for Prison Radio. Its title, There is a Storm A-Coming, Repression Breeds Revolutionary Resistance.
We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given up by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. By Martin Luther King Jr. Power never concedes anything without a demand. That demand has to come in the form of collective and massive revolutionary resistance. Today in America, still having the 13th Amendment as an enforceable constitutional law, once any human being is convicted of a crime in this country, they are considered goods of enslavement. America, with 5% of the world's population, has 25% of its prisoners. Mass incarceration, which means a perpetual crisis of prisoners re-entering society, has generated an understanding of solitary confinement's consequences, which is absolutely negative on the human spirit, mind, and body. When used as a suppressor of resistance for long-term condition, for an estimated 25,000 prisoners held in state and federal plantations, and perhaps 80,000 others in isolation sections in other prisons, are being exploited through enforcement of this arbitrary, unconstitutional law, the 13th Amendment. The condition of imprisonment is tantamount to enslavement. Coupled with the exploitation of involuntary servitude, i.e. forced prison labor, there inevitably becomes a time that the human spirit says enough is enough. In 1842, Charles Dickens wrote, after visiting an Eastern State prison in Philadelphia that opened in 1829, he stated these following words: "I hold this slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain to be immeasurably worse than any torture of the body. And because its ghastly signs and tokens are not so palpable to the eye and sense of touch as scars upon the surface, and it extorts few cries that human ears can hear, therefore I more denounce it as a secret punishment which slumbering humanity is not raised up to stay. The inevitable collective movement given birth surrounding labor exploitation and the Attica uprising last year was a calm before the storm, a universal fellowship of oppressed souls tired of their current conditions of being rendered slaves, has said no more. Power to the people. September the 9th through September the 12th will forever be recognized as the days a nation behind bars was built. When prison crats start walking off their jobs or refusing to be agents of prison exploitation, the movement is winning. When we can improve our lives of communication from state prison to federal prison to move as one, we are winning. When social media can be taken advantage of and promote a prison-wide national protest, we are winning. When a massive show of unity can foster national solidarity, we are winning. And it feels great. When we fight, we win. History has already been made. Our voices and demands have been heard. There's a storm coming, and nothing and nobody can stand in its way. Repression breeds resistance, and that resistance is you and me. All power to the people. This is Brother Kalfani Malik Khaldun, also known as Leonard McQuay, P.O. Box 1111, Carlisle, Indiana, 47838. Please contact me if you want any responses or you want a copy of this. Power to the people. Thank you.
And that's it.
for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.